We're going to pay a visit now to the Vita Needle Company in Needham, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. Nearly half its employees are senior citizens, and they're helping keep the company in the black. Reporter Ari Daniel Shapiro has this report.
Rows of work tables fill the modest-sized production floor of the Vita Needle Company. A couple dozen workers operate machines that grind and shape an assortment of tiny tubular products, things like needles, syringes, and wires. It's pretty much the same here as it was in 1932 when Vita Needle got its start, 78 years ago. And many of the employees got their start in life even before that. Like Rosa Finnegan, who's been at Vita Needle for 13 years.
I hate to tell you, I'm 98 and a half.
That half is important.
That's right. I'm trying to make it to 99. I hope I do.
On this particular day, Finnegan's stamping hundreds of small metal parts that look like pencil erasers. The arthritis is visible in her hands, but the exercise from her job helps keep her fingers reasonably nimble.
I thought retirement with my husband would be nice, but passed away with a heart attack, so life changed drastically after that. My plans all went astray. I had to make new ones. So this is how I did it.
Finnegan works 5 hours a day, and there's a real community for her here. Vita Needle employs 20 senior citizens part-time on the production floor, and they're all treated very well.
And I can go as fast or as slow as I want. No one pushes me. Makes the time go by.
Vita Needle is as competitive as ever, holding on to 10% of the market in tubular products. They're projecting $9 million in sales this year. Frederick Hartman II is the director of marketing and engineering. He's 27 and the youngest member of this family-run business.
There's a sense of pride in the senior citizens and the work that they do here. Some may not work at a faster pace, but they will produce a quality product.
This phenomenon's bigger than Vita Needle. Between 1985 and 2008, the percentage of those working over the age of 65 rose from 11 to 17%. Katrin Lynch is an associate professor of anthropology at Olin College in Needham.
It doesn't make sense for people to retire at 65. The retirement age was established when people didn't live much longer than that. Now people retire and still might have a third of their life to live.
Lynch says hiring seniors can make economic sense. Older workers often appreciate flexible hours, and for a business, this means affordable part-time employment. And companies don't have to provide benefits since Medicare tends to cover the seniors' medical needs. The arrangement also makes good social sense.
Work is so much more than just a paycheck. I think that Vita Needle is an example of a human desire for connection with others and having a sense of purpose.
That's certainly true of Bill Furson. He's 92 and has been at Vita Needle for over 20 years. The money helps him pay his bills, but there's more to it than that, and it has to do with the people he's met here.
A lot of them are in the same boat I'm in. You're single, and, you know, at my age, all my friends are gone. But I get up in the morning, I got someplace to go, I got people to meet, I got something to do.
Goes to show that our most productive years may still be ahead, well ahead. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Almost every weekend on this program for the past few months, we've been asking America's top economists for ideas on how to tackle slow growth and high unemployment. And this past week, we spoke with MIT's Peter Diamond. He's this year's Nobel laureate in economics, and he won based in part on his research into why unemployment stays high for long periods during economic downturns. And here's what he says is happening at the moment.
Well, first of all, we don't have enough aggregate demand. We don't have enough opportunity for sales for businesses to want to expand and hire workers. And people think of unemployment often relative to a simple model. There are jobs, there are workers. Why don't they just match up?
Right, right.
But in fact, the labor market has enormous numbers of flows, millions of workers finding new jobs, losing jobs. Firms seeking to hire. It takes a little while to fill a vacancy. And so it's a process that takes time as people look for jobs.
And that's normal. That's what always happens.
That's what always happens. What's critical is not right now the functioning of the labor market, but the limits on the demand for labor coming from the caution on the side of both consumers and firms because of the great uncertainty of what's going to happen next.
As you know, on this program, we've been canvassing economists from around the country, asking for ideas on how to tackle slow growth and high joblessness. This is your expertise. You have been given the Nobel Prize in the year when your research really is probably more relevant than it's been ever. You point out that demand for labor is down. What would be the best way to boost that demand?
The clearest, simplest way to hold down unemployment is for the federal government to give more money to the states so the states will stop laying off teachers, police, other workers. Mm-hmm. The layoffs from state and local government are, first of all, bad in and of themselves because a lot of what these people do is so valuable. But secondly, when they become unemployed and they spend less, that cuts down the demand. And we should be pursuing valuable expenditures now at a time when the cost to the economy, the cost to society is a lot less because a large fraction of what gets employed will be pulled away from unemployment.
So in other words, there has to be, you're arguing, some kind of additional stimulus, at least some more short-term government spending, even at the risk of increasing deficits. It just has to be done.
Yes, I'm inclined to believe that that's the case. And there's so much uncertainty now between the era of doing too little and doing too much. Doing too little seems to me to be much greater risk.
Peter Diamond, most of the economists we've spoken to on this program over the past few months asking them this question, even those who believe in austerity, who say we need to begin to cut, all of them have said, with one exception, that at least in the short term, the federal government has to spend money to stimulate the economy. Why do you think that many, many politicians in Washington don't want to do it?
We have the experience of the first stimulus bill, which by all of the quantitative estimates produced a huge amount of additional employment. But that stimulus bill has extreme unpopularity with the American public.
Right.
Even though in the eyes of economists, overwhelmingly, it was a great success.
Because when you guys look at the numbers, you say, forget about the politics, here's what would have happened if it wasn't passed.
Well, what we're looking at is the counterfactuals.
Right.
What would have happened without it? And a counterfactual is not a great political device as opposed to, hey, we did that and it didn't work as well as had been projected. Well, I think it probably did. It's just that the other factors in the economy came out to be considerably worse than were being projected at the time. So the public looks at what's happening. Things are going badly. We did a stimulus bill, so why should we do another? And the economists say things would have been a lot worse if we hadn't done the stimulus bill, and that's why we need to do another. And that's a tough political sell.
That's Peter Diamond. He's the 2010 Nobel laureate in economics and a professor at MIT. Peter Diamond, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. The nation's largest banks have delayed thousands of foreclosures while they investigate problems with faulty paperwork. But every step of the way, bank executives have insisted that they have not foreclosed in error. Consumer advocates say that may be wishful thinking. NPR's Tamara Keith introduces us to a man who says the bank shouldn't have foreclosed on his house, and now the bank agrees.
At 10 a.m. on July 26th, Bank of America foreclosed on Mark Forrester's home in Lake Oswego, Oregon. But he didn't find out about it until 2 weeks later.
This is the door. And
when he found an eviction notice taped to the front door of his condo.
I was actually opening the door to talk to a neighbor. I look and I'm like, what's this tape? You know, it was taped to the door here. And then I'm looking at it and I'm reading it and I didn't know what to do.
The thing is, Forrester's home wasn't supposed to go to foreclosure. Like hundreds of thousands of others, Forrester lost his job in late 2008. He was out of work for 6 months, stopped paying his mortgage, and then when he did start working again, he was making less money. The only way he could possibly keep his house was to get a loan modification from the bank. Just a month before the foreclosure sale went through, Bank of America offered to cut his interest rate and extend the term of his loan. His payment would drop significantly. It was exactly what he needed.
So then I signed everything and sent it off and and thought, you know, it was done. I just figured, you know, the next month I'll be back on track making my new monthly payment. And it hasn't been that way.
Instead, he's been fighting to get Bank of America to reverse a foreclosure it admits never should have happened. The eviction proceedings only stopped late last week, 2 months after Forrester says a Bank of America representative assured him it was being fixed, and only after NPR inquired about Forrester's case.
I talked to so many people, it was insane how many different people I had to talk to.
It's not like Forrester was current on his mortgage. No, he hadn't paid in more than a year. But the moment Forrester returned his documents to the bank, the foreclosure should have been stopped in its tracks. It wasn't. Dan Fromm, senior vice president at Bank of America Home Loans, says this was a case of human error. The person who received Forrester's signed documents didn't enter them into the system.
Fortunately, that's relatively rare, but unfortunately, we're talking about an individual's home, and this is an understandably stressful situation for everyone involved.
At Bank of America and all the major servicers, the lengthy foreclosure process moves forward in tandem with efforts to help people stay in their homes. Fromm says there are checks in place to prevent these types of foreclosure and error, but in Forrester's case, they failed. And Fromm admits these types of mistakes do happen.
The systems that are in place to support this, you know, massive operation now is one that has more manual steps and dependencies than we would like to count on.
It's not an isolated incident.
Alexa Milton is with Affordable Housing Centers of America. She and a staff of counselors work with lenders on behalf of homeowners to get loan modifications.
We're seeing people who shouldn't have gone to foreclosure sale go to foreclosure sale.
Milton says most of those people were still in the process of working out a modification. She says what happened to Forrester is more rare, but
it's something that we've seen increasingly over the last 5 or 6 months, and it seems to be getting worse, not better.
Mark Forrester is still in his house, and Bank of America insists everything really is fixed now. But Forrester says he still hasn't gotten confirmation in the mail from B of A, and he doesn't know what to believe anymore.
With what I've gone through in this whole process, you know, I can't trust anything that's being said until I actually have something in my hands in writing.
He says if this nightmare really is over, he looks forward to paying his mortgage again. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Even as Americans pause to vote today, the business of America goes on, and that includes the business of the government. Today, a key committee of the Federal Reserve begins 2 days of meetings. Tomorrow, we learn how the Fed intends to improve the economy if it can. One possibility is that they would flood the system with more money, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
When it comes to monetary policy, the Federal Reserve has two basic mandates: keep inflation in check and keep the unemployment rate low. Ken Kuttner is a former Fed economist and a professor at Williams College.
Inflation is below the Fed's comfort zone, and obviously with 9.6% unemployment, that's some distance from full employment, so they feel they have to try something.
But the thing they'd normally turn to, a short-term interest rate called the Fed funds rate, has been at or near zero for a very long time. You could say the Fed is out of bullets there. James Hamilton is an economics professor at UC San Diego.
It is time to try something else. And unfortunately, those something else's available aren't nearly as effective or reliable as our standard gun.
The something else the Fed appears to be loading into the chamber is called quantitative easing. I asked Ken Kuttner if there was a less technical term.
Let's see. What is it? What's a good synonym for quantitative easing? Now you should think about that. That's a good question. Large-scale bond purchases is much better, is it?
No. He emailed later to suggest the somewhat catchier binge bond buying. Basically, the Fed would go out and buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth of long-term treasury bonds. Kuttner says the Fed would mostly buy those bonds from banks. But instead of using existing money, the Fed would just credit the bank's accounts, creating billions of dollars in new money with the keystroke. Or in short,
well, printing money to buy bonds, get interest rates down, juice the economy.
Just how this would juice the economy is up for debate. Banks would have more cash on hand, though it's not clear they'd use it to make more loans. If it works, interest rates would be lower for mortgages and business loans. And all those dollars flowing around could deflate U.S. currency, making American exports more appealing. Or it could be more trouble than it's worth, says Stanford's John Taylor.
I don't think it will do much good, and I also worry about the harm down the road.
One possible impact is ballooning inflation years out. Japan tried it to get its economy out of a slump, with mixed results. And the Fed itself did a little of the same during the height of the financial crisis. Still, Taylor says we're talking about a largely untested tool.
No one knows. Even the Fed admits this. They don't know what the impact is going to be. It's very uncertain. So that uncertainty itself creates instability.
But if there is still ammunition left to try, James Hamilton at UC San Diego says the Fed ought to give it a shot.
I think we should also be nervous about doing nothing. When unemployment is as high as it is now, for as long as it's been, and as long as it's likely to continue, that's also very damaging and destructive, and something sensible people should be very nervous about as well.
We'll get more details about the Fed's bond-buying plans and whether they really qualify as a binge tomorrow afternoon. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.